You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although it's quite rich in natural resources, Zimbabwe is a country in economic crisis. Inflation has risen to more than 2.2 million%, and famine, poverty, and political repression are commonplace. Most observers believe that Robert Mugabe, who has ruled Zimbabwe for nearly 30 years, stole the last election through violence and intimidation, and will do anything he has to do to remain in power, no matter how much international pressure is applied on him to step down. Here with some background on Zimbabwe's political and economic crises is Joshua Hammer, foreign correspondent and former Africa Bureau chief for Newsweek. Welcome to our show.
Thanks a lot, Leonard.
And you're talking to us now from Berlin. Have you moved to covering Germany?
No, my wife is German. My kids are half German, and it's just a kind of a nice base to cover the world. It's a great city.
Morgan Tsvangirai claims to have won on March 29th in those elections. Does anyone believe that Mugabe got enough votes to force that runoff?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer. I was in Zimbabwe during this time. This was March for about a week before, during, and after the election. And in fact, the Independent Election Observer Group came out with some numbers that indicated that Tsvangirai had not gotten a majority. I think they called him at about 49%. So if that's accurate, then in fact Mugabe was entitled to a runoff vote.
So then why did Tsvangirai drop out of the runoff?
He dropped out of the runoff because as soon as the ruling party began to prepare for this runoff, it was clear there was a clear decision made that they would use every means possible to intimidate and kill and beat and harass and anyone in the opposition, and therefore guarantee a victory for Mugabe. Once Tsvangirai, it took him about a month, I believe, to realize the extent of this this government plan. And when he realized how pervasive it was and that continuing to run would simply risk the lives of a lot more people, he decided that he had no choice but to withdraw.
How many people are estimated to have been killed or maimed during this election cycle?
Well, I think the figure is something about like 100 murdered, which, you know, in the scheme of things, I suppose is not a huge amount of people. But there were thousands of people injured, and there were tens of thousands of people who were displaced. And the fact is that you don't really need to. The point of this campaign was really to instill a tremendous amount of fear in anyone who supported Tsvangirai and the opposition. So you didn't really need to conduct a massive killing campaign, which Mugabe has done in the past. In the early 80s, he did that. But there was a tactical decision made that they would go after a handful of prominent, but not, you know, internationally known opposition leaders who were known in their communities, who were known in their provinces, that they would kill those people and send a message that would permeate the rural areas that if you vote for the opposition, this is the fate that awaits you. So it was a very well thought out, calculated, and effective campaign of targeted violence.
How many elections has Zimbabwe held during Mugabe's years in office?
Well, at the contested elections, the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, came into being in 1999. And so 2000 was the first genuinely contested election that Mugabe had. He was not running for, that was a parliamentary election where parliament, where he almost lost control of parliament. That was a real wake-up call for Mugabe. Then came 2002, which was a presidential election, which was marked by tremendous violence. That was again Tsvangirai versus Mugabe, and Mugabe won that by ballot box stuffing and killing and torturing opposition members. It was a tremendously violent campaign that really didn't come onto the international radar screen the way this one did. And then there was a 2005 election, a parliamentary 2000, and then 2008. So there have been four total since the MDC came into being.
Despite all that, doesn't Mugabe still enjoy a lot of support?
It's hard to gauge how much support Mugabe has. It's true that he did poll supposedly about 43% of the vote, although a lot of people think that those numbers were fixed, and that, in fact, the early returns, apparently within 24 hours of the election, Mugabe's own people were telling him that he won about 20% of the vote. So there's wide discrepancy here about just how popular Mugabe is. I mean, certainly he enjoys the support of the Zimbabwe army, of the security forces. There are a lot of people out there in rural areas who, especially among in the Mugabe tribal heartland, Mashonaland. He's a member of the Shona tribe, and tribalism is still pervasive in a lot of Africa, and Zimbabwe is no exception. So there is a sort of core tribal clan support that will never go away. There's no question that his popularity has just plummeted over the years as the country has disintegrated in every way.
How much of the rivalry between Tsvangirai and Mugabe is tribal or ethnic or religious? Or generational,
no,
for that matter?
It's not tribal at all. They're both from the same tribe. Uh-huh. They're both from the Mashona tribe, so that's not really an issue. It's really it's a personal enmity. The two men just despise each other. And it's really a question of a vision of a future of Zimbabwe. I mean, I've seen Morgan Tsvangirai in action for a number of years, and he's an impressive man. I can't tell you what would happen if he ever got to power. I mean, somebody who has watched Africa for many years, I've seen all too many professed Democrats, human rights activists, etc., get into power and become ruthless autocrats. But Tsvangirai has always struck me as a real Democrat, somebody who admires Nelson Mandela. He says all the right things. He's certainly a tremendously courageous man. Yes, there's some sort of dubious things about him, I suppose. But I mean, it really is a vision of it is, I think, a democratic vision versus an autocratic, ruthless, brutal vision that Mugabe offers. So that's the distinction between the men.
I'm talking to Joshua Hammer, the former African bureau chief for Newsweek magazine, looking at what's going on in Zimbabwe today, because we hear the day's story, but we really have no sense often, or not given enough of a sense, of what's behind all of it. Mugabe must be seen by some people in the country as their liberator, has that all been lost because of all the crises in the country?
No, I don't think it has been lost. I think it's not only is he seen inside the country as a liberator, but he's seen by many Africans and certainly many African leaders as a liberator. I mean, that heroic role that he played in the 1970s, defeating the white minority racist regime of Ian Smith, a guerrilla war, bringing independence to Zimbabwe, black majority rule. The early days of his leadership, he was actually, I don't know how many of us can recall those days, the early 1980s, Mugabe was actually seen as a progressive, heroic figure. He vastly improved literacy in the country. He made schools available to a lot of people who didn't have schools before. He went out and preached racial reconciliation with the white minority, which was very frightened, because this was a time when other countries like Mozambique and Angola, a lot of countries with sizable white populations, were going independent after wars, and white populations were fleeing and taking much of the infrastructure and educational knowledge with them, and plunging these countries into complete destitution. Mugabe went out in those days and really, really preached reconciliation and told whites that they would be safe, that they were welcome to partake of the new country, and it worked. So that vision of Mugabe as a liberator, as a heroic figure, is still very present in the minds of many Zimbabweans and people like and peers like Thabo Mbeki, the leader of the president of South Africa, and I think that is one of the reasons that there is still a tremendous amount of resistance on the part of African leaders to criticize him openly.
So when did things change? In 2002, when he, when the government seized most of the white-owned farms?
That began to happen actually 2 years earlier in 2000. I think 2000, by 2002, it was really it had accelerated and become a true epidemic. But you have to place the seizure of white-owned farms together with the rise of the Movement for Democratic Change, the first real opposition group. Mugabe was quite paranoid at the time, and he really was becoming a ruthless. I mean, he'd always shown ruthless autocratic tendencies, and those got progressively worse over time. And by 1999, 2000, I mean, he was a staunch advocate of one-party rule. He wasn't going to go anywhere. Suddenly, he saw this group of upstarts come and proclaim that they were an opposition movement that wanted free and fair elections. They did have a lot of support from white farmers in the country who really sort of ran the economy in those days. So Mugabe basically sought revenge against these white farmers. He kind of viewed this as killing two birds with one stone, really, by seizing all these white-owned farms and then turning them over to cronies and members of the so-called Zimbabwe War Veterans Group, a sort of radical agitation movement for land reform. He was able to kind of get his revenge against the white population, which he viewed as betraying him, and also placate this very noisy, very active group that wanted white farms, that had become very aggressive and was demanding a lot of support. So that, and then when the campaign of violent land reform really was set into motion, like 2000-2001. Of course, all of these farms, which were really the engine of the Zimbabwean economy, were seized and pretty quickly run into the ground. And that's when you have the beginning of this dramatic decline in the Zimbabwe economy and just astonishing. I mean, I was there in 1990 for the first, my first trip there was in 1990 for the 10th anniversary of Zimbabwe's independence. And I went back, I think, 13 years later, and just sort of astonished at the disintegration. And then I've been back over the last 4 years. I've probably been back three or four times since then, and each trip just is kind of a journey into further this disintegration, destruction, economic collapse. It just gets worse every time.
Well, why has it gotten so bad? After all, whether it was white farmers or black farmers, a country like Zimbabwe, which was a major producer of agricultural goods, tobacco, and other things, it still has rich farmland, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's fallow farmland. The farming collapsed. The know-how was destroyed. There was nobody who knew how to farm. The white population. Basically fled the country or were forced to leave to move into flats in her apartments in Harare. Unfortunately, they did have the know-how. They had the agricultural know-how. There was not a lot of effort made to spread that knowledge around.
And they had kept the black population illiterate throughout the years of Rhodesia.
I don't think we want to let the white population off the hook by any means. And in fact, there was a great disparity of wealth and land, but. Talk to somebody like Morgan Tsvangirai about this, and he will agree that there was definite inequality that needed to be addressed. But the way that Mugabe went about it, with this kind of ill-planned, impulsive, violent seizures of land and turning it over to people who really had no experience, was suicidal. It was a terribly thought-out, totally destructive plan. And all you have to do is look at the agricultural figures in the country, and you see that agricultural production dropped, I believe, 80 or 90%. I mean, this tobacco and other crops really represented the majority of the country's foreign exchange. So they suddenly faced this tremendous shortage of foreign exchange, and they couldn't buy things. They could not buy things on the international market. That began to precipitate the collapse of everything else. You had I'm not an economist by any means, but the Mugabe made up for these shortfalls. He had to pay people, so there was this wanton printing of money, really unrestrained, and that precipitated this hyperinflation that just keeps getting worse and worse. I mean, it's just astronomical. I don't think there's been an inflationary spiral like this in perhaps in certain wars in the past, but.
Well, it's worse than what happened during the Weimar years in Germany.
It is.
We have to take a little break, and we'll return to that. My guest is Joshua Hammer, who is the former African bureau chief for Newsweek and the author of three books, none of them about Africa, actually, the Middle East, Asia, but does know an awful lot about Zimbabwe, which he has visited on and off over the years. And we will continue this conversation right after this. We're back with Joshua Hammer, who was until fairly recently the Africa Bureau Chief and Correspondent at Large for Newsweek, now working as a freelance foreign correspondent. We're talking about Zimbabwe and the crisis there, a country that is known for its natural beauty with Victoria Falls, one of the wonders of the world. Was tourism an important source of income in the past?
Yeah, definitely. I remember, and it was an amazing place for tourism. I lived in Kenya for 4 years in the early 90s, mid-90s, for when I was my first go-around as Newsweek's bureau chief, and in Africa, and that was Kenya was a wonderful. In those days, it was a corrupt and decrepit country, but it had one thing it did have was a great tourist infrastructure. However, when I got to Zimbabwe and saw and made the comparison, I was just blown away by how actually much more impressive Zimbabwe's tourist infrastructure was. It was just everything ran really smoothly, and it was just from Hwange National Park, where you could walk through herds of elephant, to Victoria Falls, as you point out, one of the wonders of the world. I remember Lake Kariba, these houseboats where you would stay on houseboats and take out motorboats and wander around and be able to go right up to elephants on the shoreline, and then canoeing down the Zambezi River with past hippos and crocodiles. It was just this varied, astonishing tourist paradise that I think was really the finest in Africa. I can't.
Is that pretty much lost now?
You know, I went back there in 2000 and what year was it? It was 2005 because I was living in South Africa at the time, and I was wondering what had happened to the infrastructure, and there were reports in the South African papers about a meltdown of tourism there. So I went up to Hwange National Park and traveled around with a photographer, and they were suffering from a drought. There was no money for pumps. They couldn't fill the boreholes, the water holes. Elephants were dying. We just encountered the corpses of several dozen elephants out there in the bush. Lots of other animals dying. There was just no money. Everything was collapsing. The rangers were allegedly involved in poaching because they weren't getting paid salaries, so it was the only way they could survive. They couldn't get spare parts. They couldn't repair the pumps, as I said. It was really tremendously sad, and one could only imagine that it's gotten worse. When I was there, I did make some inquiries from some friends of mine in the tourist industry, and they said there was no more tourism. It's completely disappeared. It's not entirely true. There was a small, sort of a bizarre, surreal little island of tourism up at Victoria Falls, where they still have these packaged tourists coming in, and Victoria Falls Hotel, this old colonial structure, the government sort of keeps pouring money, whatever little money it has, it pours into maintaining this Victoria Falls Hotel as a kind of facade of what used to be, a remnant of what used to be.
Now
other than that, that's pretty much it.
You mentioned Kenya, another country where the anti-colonial heroes became increasingly authoritarian, but they caved in somewhat to international pressure. Why do you think that hasn't happened in Zimbabwe despite all of these problems?
Well, When you say caved in, we're talking about the recent power-sharing deal, I guess.
Yes.
Right? The most recent thing that ended at,
I mean, where power-sharing doesn't, according to the most recent news reports, doesn't look like it's in the offing in Zimbabwe.
I never thought it would be. I mean, when I heard about Mugabe reaching out, I was always skeptical that there would be any kind of... I just don't think he has any ability to compromise. I mean, he's never shown the slightest interest in compromise. He is a... I think that it's really a question of personalities here. The guys up in Kenya... Raila Odinga and Kabila, Laurent Kabila. No, not Kabila, is it?
No, he's in Congo.
Yes, of course. I plead momentary lapse of memory here. But look, there was a power-sharing deal because neither of those guys was, they saw how close Kenya had come to the brink, and neither of them wanted to take it that far. And so, you know, thanks to a certain extent to a good mediation by Kofi Annan but I think mostly the rational behavior of leaders who saw the danger and probably looked to Zimbabwe as an example and the surrounding countries. I mean, they were surrounded by places like Rwanda, Burundi, Congo, Uganda, places that were marked by failure. And Somalia, of course, and Sudan. I mean, the whole East Africa is just a graveyard of hope, to use a cliche.
Well, Mugabe is 84 years old. I mean, I'm sure he has enough money socked away to live very happily.
Not only that, I don't think we can place it all on Mugabe. Mugabe is certainly he's old. He's old, and he may not have the fight left in him like as he used to. He is surrounded by some very powerful, very frightened military guys and ruling party cronies who are terrified of war crimes trials and terrified that if Tsvangirai gets into power, despite all the overtures he's made and all the attempts he's made to mollify these people and tell them, I'm not going to go after Mugabe. I'm not going to go after these military leaders. We're going to let bygones be bygones. This is one of the, when I met him, when I had breakfast with him on election day in March, and this is one of the messages he was most insistent on getting across, was, you know, no trials, no turning over anybody to the International Criminal Court, bygones be bygones. He said it several times. But there is this tremendous fear and tremendous distrust of Tsvangirai, and these guys are willing to fight. They have a long history of corruption and killing and torturing, the kind of thing that really didn't exist to that extent, anywhere near that extent in Kenya. You didn't have that same sort of dynamic in place of people who are just terrified to give up power because of consequences for themselves. So to a certain extent, I really do think that that's what it's all about. That's what Mugabe is, why Mugabe and his henchmen are really, really reluctant to even give Tsvangirai an opening and make him, say, a vice president, as was one of the issues under discussion in these Pretoria talks.
My guest is Joshua Hammer. He's the former Africa Bureau chief for Newsweek. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. But sanctions have been applied by the United States and other countries. Do the sanctions hurt Mugabe and his friends, or are just the poor people of Zimbabwe affected?
Well, Mugabe has been sanctioned by the United States and by the European Union and Canada, but we do see him kind of jetting around the world and dropping in at the UN conference in Rome and strutting around, and so it doesn't seem to affect him very much at all. I would say that some of his cronies are a bit annoyed at the fact that they are on these no-fly lists, not banned from the United States or Europe or whatever. But their families, from what I understand, are still allowed to attend private schools in Europe and the United States. So I don't think it's these sanctions have affected them that badly. The sanctions are not really, they're targeted sanctions. They're really aimed specifically at Mugabe and the United States sanctions anyway, and about 250 of his members of his inner circle, of the ruling party elite and the commanders in chief. So I'm not quite sure what the economic impact of these sanctions are on the people of Zimbabwe, who are suffering enough just through these terrible economic policies of the ruling party. Now, Mugabe has been very adept at using these sanctions, the argument of that the West is made, that you are suffering because of sanctions, because of Britain and the United States are ganging up on us and making us suffer. This is a constant theme of his, and in fact, he has always presented the opposition as basically a puppet of Britain and the United States. And, you know, it's until recently been a fairly effective argument. But I, from what I understand, and I've talked to a bunch of diplomats and Zimbabweans about this, is that the argument is that the sanctions really are aimed specifically at higher-ups in the regime and not at the people themselves.
Well, he's gotten support at the UN from China and Russia. Why hasn't that had some kind of an economic side to it?
Why hasn't the support, well, you mean, had it
well,
economic boost?
Well, China, for example, has been propping up
Absolutely.
The Sudanese
government.
Yeah.
I would agree with you there. I would agree that China has, the United States, there has been, I suppose, a lack of investment from the West. Although there are still, as I believe, even a couple of years ago, I believe, I met several people and several businessmen in Harare and Bulawayo who were doing a very brisk business selling to the United States. But as far as direct investment from the U.S. and Europe, I suppose that has dropped. But, yeah, China has gotten in there in a big way. Mugabe has embraced this, what he calls this look east policy several years now. He's been proclaiming the look east policy, which means that he's invited China in, and China has some big interests in Zimbabwean mines. I believe they've started to they've even taken over some formerly white-owned farms. They have been propping up Mugabe's military. They have been propping up the ruling party itself with direct cash payouts. So it's keeping Mugabe. It's certainly keeping the ruling party propped up.
We talked earlier about the inflation rate, officially 2.2%, but actually unofficially at 12.5%. Wasn't it just announced that 10 zeros will be removed from the Zimbabwe dollar so that a $10 billion banknote will now be a $1 banknote?
Yeah, and I believe they did this 2 years ago as well. So it's actually that $10 billion is actually about, in fact, about 10, it was actually $10 trillion. So if you went by, I mean, it's just, it boggles the mind. I was totally confused. All I do remember when I was there last, one of the sights that I will always remember were the huge lines of people at every ATM machine in Harare, because the government just couldn't print up the money. The money was so valueless. And they couldn't print up enough of it, so people were being limited to something, and businesses and individuals were being limited to something like $12 a day, the equivalent of $12 US a day. So people were spending, you know, 3, 4, 5 hours of their day every day lining up at these banks to take out money. Okay, maybe every other day. I was running into people who were doing this 3, 4 days a week spending. It was just staggering.
I spoke to someone last year who said that she would go into a market and take a product off the shelf, and by the time she got to the checkout, the price had changed.
Yeah. Got to run. Can't walk.
Is kind of shocking. Now, why?
There's nothing in the markets anyway. I mean, I made a couple of tours through the markets. I have to say it was one of the saddest experiences of my recent reporting experiences of recent memory.
Why do they hate Morgan Tsvangirai so much? Is it because he's an upstart, because he wasn't a part of the revolutionary group, or simply because he is going to be an agent for change?
I think they're terrified of him. He's got a huge grassroots following. He's the first and the only real opposition candidate to have emerged. He's a hero to a lot of people, and every time they try to beat him down, he only becomes more popular. I mean, there was an attempt in 2007. They beat the crap out of him. You may remember The police hit him with iron bars. They smashed him on the head. They opened up a huge wound on his scalp. They broke his arms. And the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, was kind of in the dumps at the time. There had been a tribal split, accusations of violence against some of Tsvangirai's supporters. I wrote a piece for The New Yorker 2 years ago talked about this split and how I met Tsvangirai then, and he was really demoralized. The movement was demoralized. They were spending all their time attacking each other rather than going after Mugabe. After that beating, everything changed. Mugabe basically turned him into a sort of Nelson Mandela figure for Zimbabwe. He suffered stoically, and his popularity rose, and that really began the turnaround of the Movement for Democratic Change and led to this really remarkable performance in March, which, of course, we know the result of that.
Just one more thing, because we're running out of time, but Thabo Mbeki is the mediator mediating the talks, which are now officially deadlocked between Mugabe and Tsvangirai. And many people have suggested that he is not the right person for the job. It's been suggested he's acted more like a Mugabe ally, an enabler rather than a mediator. So is there any hope that somebody else will come in there?
I don't know what to tell you, whether there's anybody who has the look. South Africa is the biggest power on the continent. They have a huge economy. They have they're Zimbabwe's neighbor to a certain extent. They call the shots. Zimbabwe can't survive without South Africa's cooperation. So there's really kind of nobody on the continent who can fill the role that Mbeki has, except for Mbeki's successor. Now, Jacob Zuma is the probable successor to Mbeki, and Zuma has been a lot more critical of Mugabe and a lot more supportive of Tsvangirai in the last few months. So there's a great amount of hope from a lot of people that I don't think anybody really expects anything's going to change as long as Mbeki is in power. And I think that these power sharing talks are almost certainly going to lead nowhere. And so I think that everybody is waiting to see what happens. The elections are in 2009. Zuma will probably be the president. He is likely to take a lot harsher line towards Zimbabwe. And things might change then, might very well change then, with concerted pressure from a South African leader who has some spine.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us today, Joshua Hammer, who's a freelance foreign correspondent nowadays, former Africa Bureau chief for Newsweek.
Thank you, Leonard.